22. Auger knew it was the right number as soon as the man answered the telephone. His authoritative, slightly schoolmasterly tone only confirmed her suspicions.
Herr Altfeld?
Excuse the interruption, mein Herr, and excuse my very poor German, but I am trying to trace the Herr Altfeld, who is an employee of Caspar Metals. The call was terminated before Auger could say another word.
What happened? Floyd asked.
I think I struck gold. He rang off a little too enthusiastically.
Try again. In my experience, people always answer the telephone sooner or later.
She dialed through to the hotel switchboard again and waited while her call was connected. Herr Altfeld, once again I must...
The line crashed dead again.
Auger tried once more, but this time the telephone rang and rang without being picked up. Auger imagined the sound echoing around a well-appointed hallway, where the phone rested on a little table under a print of a familiar oil painting, a Pissarro or a Manet, perhaps. She persisted, allowing the phone to keep ringing. Eventually, her patience was rewarded by the receiver being picked up.
Herr Altfeld, please let me speak.
I have nothing to say to you.
Mein Herr, I know you talked to Susan White. My name is Auger, Verity Auger. I'm Susan's sister.
There was a pause, during which it seemed quite likely that the man would hang up the telephone again.
Fräulein White did not have the good grace to keep her appointment, Altfeld eventually replied.
That's because someone murdered her.
Murdered her? He repeated incredulously.
That's why you never saw her. I'm here in Berlin with a private detective.
Floyd's advice, tell the truth wherever possible. It could open a surprising number of doors. We think Susan was killed for a reason, and that it had something to do with the work being done at Caspar Metals.
As I said, I have nothing to tell you.
You were good enough to offer to speak to my sister, mein Herr. Will you at least do us the same favor? We won't take up much of your time, and then I promise you won't hear from us again.
Things have changed. It was a mistake to talk to Fräulein White, and it would be an even bigger mistake to talk to you.
Why? Is someone putting pressure on you?
Pressure? The man said, laughing hollowly. No, I have no pressure at all now. A generous retirement settlement saw to that.
Then you don't work at Caspar Metals anymore?
Nobody works there anymore. The factory burnt down.
Look, mein Herr, I think it would really help if we could talk. It can be anywhere of your choosing, even if it's just for 5 minutes.
I am sorry, Altfeld said, and hung up again.
Pity, Auger said, rubbing her forehead. I thought I was getting somewhere that time.
But he really doesn't want to talk to us.
We're not giving up, Floyd said.
Shall I try to ring through again?
He probably won't talk to you, but it doesn't matter. We know where he lives now.
The black Duesenberg taxi growled to a halt at one end of a leafy suburban street in the suburb of Wedding, 5 kilometers from the heart of the city. Long lines of cheaply built dwellings housed the many workers and bureaucrats who toiled in the nearby factories. The Borsig Locomotive Works was the largest employer in the area, but the Siemens factory was not far away, and there was a string of other industrial concerns in the neighborhood, including Caspar Metals, they presumed.
That's the house, Auger said, the one at the corner. What shall I tell the driver?
Tell him to pull over a couple of houses beyond it.
She said something in German. The taxi purred forward, then pulled to the side of the road and slid in between 2 parked cars.
Now what? Auger asked.
Tell him to keep the meter running while we check out the house.
Auger had another brief exchange with the driver. He says if we pay now, he'll wait another 10 minutes.
Then pay the man.
Auger had already changed some of her funds into Deutschmarks. She passed a couple of notes to the taxi driver and repeated her instruction for him to wait. The driver turned off the engine and they got out.
I'm impressed with your German, Floyd commented as they opened the garden gate and walked up the little gravel path to the front door. Is that what they teach all the nice young spies?
They thought it might come in handy, Auger said.
Floyd rang the bell. Presently, a shape loomed behind the frosted glass and the door creaked open. The man standing in the hallway was in his 50s or 60s, dressed in shirt and braces, with small metal-rimmed spectacles and a neatly trimmed mustache. He was shorter and thinner than Floyd. His features were delicate, and in his very fine hands he held a duster and an item of pottery.
Herr Altfeld, Auger said,
followed by something in German that included the word telephone.
That was as far as she got before the man closed the door.
"Shall I try again?" she asked.
"He won't open it. He doesn't want to speak to us." Auger leaned in and rang the bell, but the man did not reappear.
"That was him, though, don't you think?"
"I guess so. This is the address that goes with the number you called."
"I wonder what's got him so scared."
"I can think of a thing or two," Floyd said. They walked back down the garden path and closed the gate behind them.
"Short of breaking in and tying him to a chair," Auger said, "how would you suggest we proceed now?"
"We wait in the taxi. If you can keep the driver copacetic, we'll just sit tight here until Altfeld makes a move."
"You think he will?"
"Once he's sure we've left the neighborhood. He'll want to get out of that house so he doesn't have to put up with us ringing the doorbell or calling him on the telephone."
"This is all familiar territory to you, I guess, Wendell."
"Yes," he said, "but usually the worst thing I have to worry about is a slug on the chin."
"And this time?"
"A slug on the chin sounds just dandy."
Auger persuaded the taxi driver to take them once around the block, so that they would appear to be leaving the scene if Altfeld happened to be watching them from behind his curtains. Once they had returned to Altfeld's road, the taxi driver parked the car in a different space, further up the road than before, but still within sight of the house on the corner.
"Tell the driver he may be in for a long wait," Floyd said, "but that we'll pay him more than he'd earn taking other rides."
"He still doesn't like it," Auger said, after passing on Floyd's instructions. "He says it's his job to take fares, not play private detective."
"Feed him another note."
She opened her purse again and spoke to the driver, who shrugged and took the proffered money.
"What does he say now?" Floyd asked.
"He says he could get used to his new profession."
They waited and waited. The driver thumbed through the Berliner Morgenpost from front to back. Just when Floyd was beginning to doubt himself, the front door of Altfeld's house opened, and a man emerged wearing a raincoat and carrying a small greaseproof paper bag. Altfeld closed the garden gate behind him and set off down the street, stopping next to one of the parked cars and getting inside. The vehicle, a black 1950s Bugatti with white wall tires, grumbled into life and bounced away down the road.
"Tell the driver to follow that car," Floyd said, "and remind him to keep a nice distance."
Contrary to Floyd's expectations, the taxi driver turned out to be reasonably proficient at tailing the other car, with Floyd only having to urge him to hold back once or twice. Two or three times, the driver swerved confidently down a side road and re-emerged after some twists and turns just a few cars behind the one they were following. The pursuit took them back into town along more or less the same route they'd followed to reach Wedding. Soon they had crossed the Spree and were skirting the edge of the Tiergarten, Berlin's vast green lung. Near the western end, not far from the Hotel Am Zoo, the Bugatti slowed and veered into a parking place. The taxi cruised past, only stopping when they had turned a corner. Auger paid off the driver while Floyd walked to the corner and eyed Altfeld's car. He was just in time to observe the man emerge from the car, still carrying the paper bag. They followed him all the way to the elephant gate of the Zoologische Garten, watching from a distance as he paid his entrance fee and strolled inside. Floyd knew the zoo very well. Greta and he had visited it on almost every one of their trips to Berlin, strolling around on carefree afternoons until the sky turned dark and the shimmering neon lights of the city beckoned. Overhead, the sky threatened rain but never quite delivered it, like a yapping dog with no bite. Early on a Sunday afternoon, the zoo was beginning to fill up with families, accompanied by fractious children who had a habit of bursting into tears at the slightest provocation. Floyd and Auger bought tickets and kept a decent distance between themselves and Altfeld. The crowds were just thick enough to provide cover, while still allowing frequent glimpses of the man in the raincoat. They followed Altfeld to the penguin enclosure. Ringed by a spiked iron fence, it was a sunken concrete landscape of artificial rocks and shelves, surrounding a shallow, squalid-looking lake. It was feeding time. A young man in shorts flung fish at the anxious, pressing mob of penguins. Altfeld stood by the railings, at the front of the small gathering of onlookers. There was no sign that he knew he was being followed. Soon the zookeeper picked up his empty bucket and moved elsewhere, and Altfeld took that as his cue to dig into his little paper bag and hurl silvery titbits to the birds. Across the bowl of the penguin enclosure, someone caught Floyd's eye. It was Auger. She had made her way to the other side and had somehow managed to get to the front of the crowd of spectators,
and was now pressed hard against the railings. Rather than paying attention to Altfeld, she was staring in obvious, transfixed fascination at the bustling congregation of penguins, with their neat black morning suits, silly little flippers, and expressions of utmost dignity, even as they belly-flopped into the water or fell over backwards. It was as if she had never seen penguins before. Floyd guessed they didn't have many zoos in Dakota. The onlookers began to disperse, leaving only a few people behind, amongst them Altfeld. As he flung the birds the last few scraps from his bag, he watched the penguins with the resigned detachment of a general overseeing some appalling military defeat. Floyd and Auger approached the old man. "Herr Altfeld?" Auger asked. He looked around sharply, dropping the paper bag, and replied in English, "I don't know who your people are, but you should not have followed me." "We only need you to answer a few questions," Floyd said. "If I had anything to say, I would have already said it." Auger stepped closer. "I'm Verity," she said. "Susan was my sister. She was murdered 3 weeks ago. I know you corresponded with her about the Kaspar contract. I think her murder had something to do with whatever that contract was for." "There's nothing I can tell you about that contract." "But you know the contract we mean," Floyd said. "You know it was out of the ordinary." He kept his voice low. "An artistic commission. Nothing special about that." "You don't believe that, as comforting as it might seem," Auger said. "All we need to know," Floyd said, "is where the objects were sent. Just one address will do. Even if I was prepared to tell you, which I am not, that information no longer exists." "You don't keep your paperwork filed away somewhere for reference?" Auger asked, raising an eyebrow in surprise. "The documentation was disposed of." Floyd blocked Altfeld's view of the birds. "But you must remember something." "I never committed those details to memory." "Because someone told you not to?" Auger asked. "Was that what happened, Mr. Altfeld? Did someone put pressure on you not to pay too much attention?"
"It was a complicated contract. Of course I paid attention."
"Give us something," Floyd said. "Anything. Just the approximate district in Paris to which one of the spheres was shipped would be better than nothing."
"I don't remember."
"Was the function of the spheres ever discussed?" Floyd persisted.
"As I said, it was an artistic commission."
Altfeld's voice had become tense, and his composure seemed ready to snap at any moment. "Kaspar Metals was engaged in many other metallurgical contracts during the same period. Provided the specifications were followed, there was no need for us to question the subsequent use to which the items would be put."
"But you must have been curious," Floyd said.
"No, I had no curiosity whatsoever."
"We think the spheres might be part of a weapon," Auger said. "At the very least, components of something with a military application. The same thought must have occurred to you. Didn't that give you pause for thought?"
"The purpose of the objects was a matter for the Export Bureau, not me."
"Nice get-out," Floyd said.
Altfeld looked up at him. "If questions had been raised, export of the objects would have been blocked. They were delivered, so the matter is closed."
"And that lets you off the hook, does it?" Floyd asked.
"My conscience is clear. If this troubles you, I apologize. May I be permitted to watch the penguins in peace now?"
"That contract was part of something evil," Auger said. "You can't wash your hands of it that easily."
"What I do with my hands," Altfeld said, "is entirely my business."
"Tell us what you know," Floyd insisted.
"What I know is that you should stop asking questions and leave this matter alone. Leave Berlin now, and return to wherever it is you came from."
He regarded Auger.
"I can't place your accent. I am normally very good, even with English speakers."
"She's from Dakota," Floyd said, "but you don't need to worry about that. What you need to worry about is telling me who has put the fear of God into you. Don't be ridiculous." By now they were the only people anywhere near the penguin enclosure. Floyd saw his moment, knowing he'd regret his actions immediately, but also well aware that there was no other means of getting anything useful out of Altfeld. He lunged and grabbed Altfeld by the collar of his raincoat and shoved him hard against the railings with his back to the enclosure, knocking the wind out of him.
"Now listen, sehr gut," Floyd said. "I'm not an impatient man. I'm not a man who normally does this kind of thing. Matter of fact, I'm usually an easygoing sort of fellow."
Altfeld wriggled, trying ineffectually to escape Floyd's grasp.
but the problem is that a friend of mine is in a lot of trouble.
I know nothing about any friend of yours, Altfeld wheezed.
I never said you did, but this little contract of yours, the one you don't want to talk about, is connected to the trouble my friend is in. It's also connected to the murder of Miss Auger's sister. That makes two of us who'd like to get closer to the truth, and only one of you standing in our way.
Let go of me, Altfeld said. Then perhaps we can have a reasonable conversation.
Don't hurt him, Wendell, Auger said. Floyd looked around. No other spectators just yet. He kept the man pinned against the railing. This is as reasonable as it gets. Now why don't you tell me about the people who wanted these spheres made?
I will tell you nothing, except that you are better off having as little to do with them as possible.
Ah, Floyd said. Progress, of a sort. He rewarded Altfeld with a slight reduction of pressure, allowing him to stand fully on his feet again. The question is, if they're so bad, why did you deal with them in the first place? Surely Caspar Metals didn't need the work that badly. Altfeld looked around, doubtless hoping for assistance to wander by.
Work was always welcome. We were not in the business of turning contracts away.
Not even contracts as technically demanding as this one, Olga asked. He glared at her, as if she should be ashamed to have an opinion on the matter.
There was nothing unusual about it at first. The contract appeared relatively simple, as these things go. We were happy to take it on.
But as the work progressed, so did the demands for the quality of the finished product. The specification became tighter, the tolerances smaller. The copper-aluminium alloy was difficult to cast and machine. At first, we didn't even have measuring instruments capable of calibrating the object's shape to the necessary degree of accuracy, and then there was the whole business of the cryogenic suspension.
Cryogenic what?
Auger interjected, alarm bells ringing in her head.
I've said too much.
Floyd took a renewed grip on Altfeld's raincoat and lifted him higher, until the back of his collar snagged on the spiked points of the iron railings. Floyd let him dangle.
You've only just whetted my appetite.
Altfeld's breath caught in his throat.
Late in the contract, the clients revealed that the spheres would have to withstand immersion in liquid helium at a temperature only a whisker above absolute zero. This in turn created numerous difficulties. Now leave me alone.
It sounds as if you were being asked to do the impossible, Floyd said. Why didn't you just back out of the contract if the details kept changing?
We tried, Altfeld said, and that is when I learned of our client's capacity for ruthlessness. There was to be no backing out, they said.
I take it you called their bluff.
Yes,
and then one of my senior managers, the man who had conducted the last round of negotiations with my clients, was found dead in his home.
Murdered? Floyd asked.
He had been bludgeoned to death in his conservatory, yet this had happened on a sunny afternoon when his home was in full view of many witnesses. No one was seen to come and go, at least no one who could possibly have committed the crime.
Except maybe a child, Floyd said.
Altfeld nodded gravely, and suddenly all the fight drained out of him, as if he had just been told something he desperately wished not to be true. Floyd sensed the change in his mood, as if on some level Altfeld was glad to be able to talk to someone at last, no matter how fearful the consequences.
During the final stages of the contract, when the spheres were being evaluated and shipped, I saw children all over the place. They followed me wherever I went. They were always around, visible just out of the corner of my eye. I haven't seen any since the factory burnt down. I hope I go to my grave still able to say that.
They frightened you? Olga asked.
Once, I was close enough to one to look it in the face. It is an experience I hope never to repeat.
Olga leaned closer to him. I can understand you being afraid of those children, Mr. Altfeld. You were right to be afraid. They are very dangerous, and they will kill to protect their interests. But we're not working with them. In fact, we're doing all in our power to stop them.
Then you are even more foolish than I suspected. If you had any sense, you would leave this matter well alone.
We just need an address, Floyd said. A lead. That's all we're asking for. Then you won't hear from us again.
But I will hear from them.
If you help us, then maybe we can stop them before they reach you, Auger said. Altfeld let out a small, hen-like clucking sound, as if this was the least convincing reassurance he'd ever heard.
At least tell us where the production took place, Floyd said.
I will tell you nothing. If you have found your way to me, I am sure you are capable of continuing your investigation without my assistance."
Floyd found some strength he didn't know he had, and hauled Alfred even higher, lifting his collar free of the railing. He moved his grip down the buttons of his raincoat, until he had the man by the waist, and then levered him higher, until his head and upper body were leaning back over the railings, and the sheer drop into the enclosure.
Altfeld let out a gasp of fright as his center of gravity began to shift backwards.
"Tell me," Floyd hissed. "Tell me or I'll push you over."
Auger tried to pull Floyd away from Altfeld, but Floyd had had enough of lies and evasions. He didn't care how scared this man was, how innocent a part he had played in some larger conspiracy. All he cared about was Christine, and whatever it was that had made Auger wake up screaming.
"Give me an address, you bastard. Give me an address or I'll feed you to the birds."
Altfeld wheezed, as if suffering some kind of seizure. Between ragged breaths, he gasped out,
"15. Building 15.
Floyd lowered him to the ground, leaving him sagging against the railings.
That's a good start. By the time they returned to the hotel, it was too late to consider driving out to the industrial district where Caspar Metals had been located. "We'll take a cab out there first thing tomorrow," Floyd said. "Even if we don't find anyone around to talk to, there might be something left behind after the fire that we can use."
"Altfeld was keeping something back," Auger said. "What, I don't know. But he wasn't telling us the whole story."
"Do you think he knew anything about Silver Rain?"
"No, I'm pretty sure he didn't. Like I said, there simply isn't the manufacturing base available here to put it together. The metal spheres are part of something different."
"But probably related," Floyd said. "Maybe we should pay Altfeld another visit, see if we can squeeze something else out of him."
"We should leave him alone," Auger said. "He just seemed like a scared old man."
"They always do."
"Perhaps there's nothing else of use he could have told us," she said, hoping to steer Floyd away from the idea of tormenting Altfeld further.
"Maybe there isn't, but someone has to know more.
Altfeld might have handled the contracts, but whoever was doing the actual machining, the factory floor work, must have had a better idea of what those spheres were for, if they were ever going to calibrate them correctly."
"I don't know about that."
"We'll go to the site of the factory first thing tomorrow and see what we can find out. If that opens up new lines of inquiry, we'll follow them. You said there was enough money to keep us in this hotel for a while?"
"Yes," she said, "but we can't stay here forever. Or at least I can't. I need to be back in Paris by Tuesday. That means catching the overnight train tomorrow evening."
"Why the hurry? We only arrived here this morning."
"I just need to be back in Paris. Can we leave it at that?"
They went out to eat at 7, riding the S-Bahn to Friedrichstrasse, and then walking back along the banks of the Spree, until they found a cluster of restaurants near the newly refurbished Reichstag. They ate a good currywurst, followed by a chocolate cake, and listened to an old Bavarian couple trying to remember the names of all 19 of their great-grandchildren. Afterwards, Floyd and Auger walked the streets until Floyd heard live music coming from the window of a basement bar, guitar-based gypsy jazz of the kind he didn't hear enough of in Paris these days. He suggested to Auger that they spend half an hour in the bar before returning to the hotel. So down they went into the smoke and light of the music room, the sound suddenly much louder than it had been from the street. Floyd bought Auger a glass of white wine and a shot of brandy for himself. He sipped at his drink, appraising the band as faintly as he could. It was a quintet, with tenor saxophone, piano, double bass, drums and guitar. They were playing A Night in Tunisia. The guitarist was good, an earnest young man with thick glasses and a surgeon's fingers, but the rest of them needed some work. At least they had a band, Floyd thought dolefully.
"Your sort of music?" he asked Auger.
"Not really," she said with a shy expression.
"They're all right. Guitarist has it down, but he shouldn't stick with these guys. They're going nowhere."
"I'll take your word for it."
"So you don't like jazz? Or at least not this sort of jazz. That's all right. Takes all sorts to make a world."
"Yes," Auger said, nodding as if he had said something profound. "It does, doesn't it?"
"So what do you like?"
"I have trouble with music," she said.
"All music?"
"All music," she affirmed. "I'm tone deaf. It just doesn't do anything for me."
Floyd finished the brandy and ordered himself another. The band was now torturing someone to watch over me. Cigarette smoke hung in the air in frozen coils, like a crazy, cloudy sunset in monochrome.
"Susan White was the same," he said.
The same as what?
Blanchard said he never caught her listening to music.
It's not a crime, Olga replied. And how did he know what she got up to in her spare time? He can't have followed her everywhere.
She had a wireless in her room and a phonograph, Floyd said, but no one ever heard her listening to music on either of them.
Don't make a big deal out of it, Olga said. All I said was that I'm tone deaf. I don't know everything about Susan White.
Let's get out of here, said Floyd, slamming down his empty glass. The smoke's making my eyes water, and I wouldn't want anyone to think that the music or the company had anything to do with it.
They took the train back to the hotel and said a polite good night. Floyd took the couch, lying down in his shirt and trousers with a spare blanket for warmth. He couldn't sleep. The plumbing played a metallic symphony until 3 a.m. Through a gap in the curtains, he watched neon numerals flicker on and off at the base of the Everest statue and thought of Olga asleep and how little he knew about her and how much more he wanted to know.
23. The car plodded along potholed roads, jinking across buckled railway tracks and passing under spindly overhead structures, supporting conveyor belts and pipes for chemicals.
Ask him to slow down, Floyd said, tapping the taxi driver on the shoulder. I think that's a sign over there.
Olga relayed the request, then peered at the tilted wooden board Floyd had indicated, which was almost lost behind a screen of tall grass.
Magnolia Strasse. How appropriate.
This is Caspar Metal's address.
What's left of it should be here, she confirmed.
Beyond a broken-down wooden fence, a steam-driven demolition crane attended to the destruction of a low red brick factory building with a wrecking ball, swinging it through the one remaining wall in a series of gentle arcs. Although there were still a few buildings standing, the spaces between them were littered with piles of brick, shattered concrete, and twisted metal.
If there was a steelworks here, Floyd said, then someone's doing a swell job of hiding it.
The taxi driver kept the engine ticking over while they got out and stood on the only patch of dry ground amidst an obstacle course of mud and puddles. It was bitterly cold, a persistent chemical dampness permeating the air. Olga wore black trousers and a narrow-waisted black leather coat that fell to her knees. The night before, in the hotel room, she had tried to snap the heels from her shoes, but without success.
See if you can sweet-talk the driver into waiting for 15 minutes, Floyd said. We still need to check whether anybody left anything useful behind.
Olga leaned into the driver's window and opened her mouth to talk. She got her message across, but the words didn't come out with the expected fluency. Where yesterday there had been a gleaming linguistic machine, spitting out elegant, syntactically rich sentences, now there was a rusting contraption that creaked and groaned with the effort of every word. This worried her. If her German was crumbling now, what was going to be next?
He'll stay, she said, when the driver finally acquiesced.
He took some persuading.
My German's a bit rusty this morning. That didn't help.
They picked their way over dry, weed-infested ground to a gap in the fence. Two planks had fallen away, leaving a hole just wide enough for them to pass through. Floyd went first, holding back the high grass on the other side until Olga joined him.
This is awful, Olga said. There's so much damage that it's difficult to imagine a factory ever being here.
The only proof we have that there was is that letter Susan White received.
When was the letter sent?
Remember the train ticket she booked but didn't use? She was just about to come here when she was murdered. The letter was sent only a month or so before that.
Look at the ground here, Floyd said. No weeds anywhere. They haven't had time to break through the concrete yet.
Arson?
Difficult to know for sure, but I'm guessing so. The timing's too convenient otherwise.
In the middle distance, the steam-driven crane they had seen earlier was plodding over to another condemned building, its demolition balls swinging as it crunched across rubble and concrete. A pair of green bulldozers had joined it, belching acrid smoke from their diesel engines. The operators were masked and goggled, sunk down in oilskins.
Olga looked around for a place to start searching for clues.
Let's check out those buildings. See if we can find number 15, Olga said.
We don't have much time, Floyd warned.
They crossed the ruins of the factory complex until they reached the remaining cluster of buildings. The shells of the buildings looked threatening and skull-like, their roofs and upper ceilings already removed, so that the iron-gray sky was visible through the gaps and cracks in the fire-damaged structures. Olga had never much enjoyed trespassing, even when such things had been part of childhood initiation rites, and carried little risk of serious punishment. She enjoyed it even less now.
Number 15, Floyd said, pointing to a barely readable metal plaque hanging at an angle on one wall. Looks like the threat of the penguins did the trick. I must remember that the next time I have to put the squeeze on someone. They found an open door nearby. Inside the building it was dark, since most of the ceiling was still in place above the ground floor entrance. Watch your step, Verity.
I'm watching it, Auger said. Here, take this. She handed Floyd the automatic.
If there is only one gun between us, I think you should keep it, Floyd said. They make me nervous. I cling to the irrational idea that if I don't carry a gun, I won't find myself in a position where I need one.
You're in that position now. Take the automatic.
What about you?
Auger reached into her handbag and pulled out the weapon that she had taken from the war baby in the tunnel at Cardinal Lemoyne.
I have this gun, she said.
I meant a real one, Floyd said, regarding the strange lines of the weapon dubiously. But he didn't push the point. By now he had realized that Auger wasn't playing a game.
Be careful, Floyd. These people are willing to kill.
That much I do know.
And if you see a child?
Floyd looked back at her, the whites of his eyes bright in the darkness.
You want me to start shooting children now?
It won't be a child.
I'll shoot to wound. Beyond that, I'm not making any promises.
Auger looked back just before she followed Floyd inside. The demolition machines were making short work of a nondescript brick building, taking turns to rip at its carcass like hunger-crazed wolves. As the bulldozers reversed and then rolled forward again to attack, their engines raged with a dim mechanical fury. The goggled operators seemed to be holding them back rather than driving them.
Let's make this quick, Floyd. Those things seem to be getting closer.
Auger stepped further into the building and spun around to cover the entrance, but there was no sign of anyone or anything following them. Once inside, she pressed a sleeve against her mouth and nose to screen the dust from entering her lungs. It took half a minute for her eyes to adjust to the gloom. Along the two main walls, and forming an aisle down the middle, were three rows of heavy equipment, clearly too bulky or too damaged to be worth removing. There were lathes and drills and several dozen objects Auger didn't recognize, but which appeared to be related to the same business of metal finishing.
At least this looks like the right place, she said.
What's the flooring here? Floyd said. I can see right through to the basement.
Auger followed him, placing her feet exactly where Floyd had placed his. With each step, the floor creaked, dislodging dust and debris.
A crow flew away from a windowsill in a silent flurry of black. She watched it flap away into the sky, until it looked like a piece of burnt paper blowing in the wind.
There's nothing here, Auger said. No papers, no documentation. We're wasting our time.
We've still got 10 minutes. You never know what we might find.
Floyd had reached the far end of the workshop, where the rectangle of a door was just visible against the blackened plaster of the walls.
Let's see what's through here.
Careful, Floyd.
Her hand tightened on the war baby's weapon, its child-sized grip chafing against her palm.
Floyd had already pushed open the door and stepped through. She heard him cough.
There are stairs here, he said, going up and down. Want to toss a coin?
She heard the muffled collapse of another building, the howl of racing diesel engines. The demolition equipment sounded even closer.
Let's stay on this floor.
I don't think we'll find much above us, Floyd speculated. The fire damage will probably be worse the higher up we go. But something might have survived downstairs.
We're not going downstairs.
You got that torch? Floyd asked.
She followed him into the adjoining room. One set of concrete stairs rose up, leading to another dark enclosed space, while a second set descended down into even more profound darkness. Floyd took the torch from her and shone it down into the gloom.
This is a very bad idea, Auger said.
That's great coming from a woman who likes to spend her time dodging trains in tunnels.
That was an act of necessity. This isn't.
Let's see what we find. Just a couple of minutes, all right? I didn't come all this way to turn around now.
I did.
Floyd started descending, Auger close behind him. He played the torchlight ahead of him, the beam glancing off cracking walls. The stairs twisted through 90 degrees, then another 90.
There's another door here, Floyd said, trying the handle. It feels as if it's locked.
That's it, then.
She sighed, disappointed and relieved in equal measure.
We have to turn around.
Let me see if I can force it first. Hold the torch for a moment.
She took it from him, wondering, for a fleeting instant,
if she ought to use the gun to persuade Floyd to return to ground level.
"Make it quick," Auger said. "I'm really getting worried about those machines."
The door budged with an iron scrape that made her wince. Floyd could not get it open fully, but soon there was a gap wide enough for them to squeeze through. The torchlight fell on his face.
"You want to stay here while I check it out? I'll be as quick as I can."
"No," she said. "I'm sure I'll regret saying this, but I want to see whatever's in there for myself."
Fans and spears of blue-gray light rammed through gaps in the ceiling above them. It was still difficult to see anything outside the torch beam, but the room seemed to be empty.
"See anything?" Auger asked.
"No? Good. Let's go."
"There's a railing here," Floyd said. "It looks as if it runs right around the room."
He directed the torch beam towards the floor beyond the railing, revealing it to be much lower than Auger had been expecting. They had emerged onto a balcony that ran around the upper level of a two-story chamber. Picked out in random splashes of light entering through the ceiling, something huge and black and roughly spherical squatted in the middle of the floor.
"Voila," Floyd said. "One metal sphere for the use of.
Let me see."
She took the torch and shone it onto the sphere. Behind her, she was vaguely aware of Floyd shoving the door closed again, but ignored the distraction. The sphere was surrounded by many other pieces of metal and machinery, including a kind of frame or harness from which it appeared to be suspended.
"Is that what your dear departed sister was interested in?" Floyd asked, with heavy sarcasm, stepping up behind her again.
"Yes," Auger said, ignoring his tone. "What I don't understand is what it's doing here. The three spheres were supposed to be shipped out to three different addresses. I thought one of them was in Berlin."
"It was," Auger said, "but it still had to be moved from the factory to somewhere else in the city." Gently, Floyd took the torch back.
"Now at least you know the things exist."
"Hey, where are you going?"
"There's a ladder down to the floor. I want to take a closer look at that thing."
"We should be getting back to the taxi." But even as she spoke, she found herself drawn to follow him down to the floor of the underground room.
Close up, the sphere, which was indeed nearly 3 meters wide, she judged, conveyed a sense of massive solidity, even though it could just as easily have been hollow. The surface was smooth in places, irregular in others, and there was a visible crack running from one pole to the other. It hung from the cradle on a single cable, attached to a metal eye welded at the top of the sphere. Coating the upper surface of the sphere was a talcum of grey dust, like icing sugar on a pudding. In another corner of the room, hidden until they descended from the balcony, was a large upright cylinder of the kind used to hold pressurized gases, while in another was a high-sided drum-shaped enclosure about 3 meters across, like an armored paddling pool. Like the sphere, both items were covered with ash and dust. Auger touched the metal sphere. It was cold and rough beneath her fingers, and despite its apparent mass, the sphere moved slightly under the pressure from her hand.
"So what do you suppose this was?" Floyd asked.
"The letter said it was for artistic installation," Auger said. "Obviously that was a cover story. The specification was too exact for that. My guess is that the company was being asked to manufacture very precise components for a bigger machine.
A secret weapon?
Something like that.
But what kind of secret weapon can you make out of a gigantic metal ball?"
"Three gigantic metal balls, remember?" Auger said, "separated by hundreds of kilometers. There has to be a reason for that as well."
"Three secret weapons, then."
He walked away from the sphere and started rummaging through the debris-covered heaps of equipment on the nearest set of workbenches, throwing things to the floor with the casual ease of a burglar. Metal crashed and glass shattered. After a moment, Auger swore under her breath and joined in the reckless process, looking for anything, no matter how insubstantial, that might offer a lead.
"Or just one secret weapon," she said, "but so huge that it spreads across half of Europe.
It doesn't make any sense."
"No," she said, shaking her head, "it doesn't. But this is it, Floyd. This is what it was worth killing people to protect. Not just the ones we know about, but all the other people who've probably had to die while all this has been planned, financed, and put together.
Why did they leave it here, then?"
She pushed a battered old toolkit to the floor. It clattered thrillingly, spilling shiny spanners and wrenches from its innards.
"I don't think this sphere is the real thing."
"It looks real enough to me.
I mean, I don't think this was ever intended to be delivered to the client. It's too crudely finished.
and something obviously went wrong during the casting process. I'm not even sure this is aluminium or that aluminium-copper alloy Atfeld mentioned. It could just as easily be cast iron. You're thinking this was a dry run?
Yes, a tryout for the final set, so they could practice the casting and machining, and work out how to move it around afterwards. She shrugged. Or maybe it's one that went wrong and had to be abandoned during the finishing process. It doesn't really matter. What does is that it got left behind. So whoever torched this factory or arranged for its demolition. Even as he said the word, Olga heard the machines take apart another wall or floor, the roar of their engines sounding even closer and even more bestial. I don't think they had any idea this basement existed. They knew that the three main castings had been finished and delivered. My guess is that they burnt down the factory afterwards to hide any evidence of what had been made, but they never thought there might be a fourth sphere still here. Then we need to search the place really thoroughly, Floyd said. If they miss this, there's no telling what else they left behind.
You're right, Olga said. She felt her heart beating faster. She knew that she was much closer to an answer now than she had ever been. She could almost feel it, lurking at the back of her mind like a gift-wrapped present.
You're right. And it would make sense to search this room with a fine-tooth comb. But we're not going to. We're leaving now while we still can.
Just 5 minutes more, Floyd said. Somewhere in here there might be a record of the shipping addresses for the finished spheres.
Long shot, Wendell.
They were careless, or in a hurry, or they'd never have left this down here in the first place.
Because they thought someone was onto them.
Who are we dealing with, Verity? Are you ready to tell me yet?
We're dealing with very bad people, she said. Isn't that enough for you?
That depends on who's defining bad.
Floyd tapped the barrel of the automatic against the metal sphere. It made a dull clank.
Well, I guess Basso was right after all. It definitely wasn't meant to be a bell.
Basso? A metal worker contact of mine. I showed him the sketch of the blueprint from Susan's things. He said it might be a plan for a bell. He meant diving bell. I thought he meant the kind you ring.
Olga heard the roar of the demolition machines again, the crunch of stone and brick beneath their caterpillar treads.
I don't think either kind of bell would be something people had to die to protect, she said. Besides, it's broken.
Floyd tapped the gun against the sphere again, narrowing his eyes as he listened for reverberations. He moved around the object and struck it again.
You mean if it wasn't broken, it might sound prettier, he said.
Do it again.
Do what again?
Knock the metal the way you just did.
I was only trying to see if it was really solid. I still like my idea that it might be an atomic bomb.
It's not an atomic bomb. Knock it again.
Floyd tapped the automatic against the sphere, moving from spot to spot.
It rings, he said, but the sound is all off, like a cracked bell.
That's because it is cracked.
But if it wasn't, it'd ring with a much purer note, don't you think?
Floyd lowered the gun.
I guess so, if it matters.
I think it matters a lot. I think ringing is exactly what these spheres are meant to do.
I think you were right, and Basso was wrong.
24.
Floyd looked at her with half a smile.
Ringing.
Ringing.
And that's worth at least 2 murders and maybe a lot more than that?
If you're going to build a bell, build a goddamn bell.
They're not goddamned bells, she said.
Floyd pointed the butt of the automatic in her direction. For a nice girl from Dakota, you've sure developed a foul mouth all of a sudden.
You think this is foul, Olga said. You should stick around a while.
You know, you can knock that enigmatic act off any time you like. I've about had it up to here.
He had just finished speaking when there was a crash of collapsing masonry, shaking the entire room. Fist-sized shards of cement dropped from the ceiling, filling the air with powdery gray dust.
Olga coughed, shielding her eyes and mouth with her hand.
That sounded close, she said. Maybe they're already demolishing part of Building 15. We've got more than we expected. Let's get out before we're buried alive.
For once, I couldn't agree more.
They climbed the ladder back to the balcony level, Floyd leading.
The building shook again, more of the ceiling coming loose. A gap as wide as a man had appeared in it, revealing severed wood and concrete, pipes and electrical wires. Motors roared overhead, revving and ebbing as the bulldozers surged back and forth. The cast metal plinth of a lathe or a drill leaned precariously over the hole.
Move!
Auger hissed.
They ran around the balcony until they reached the door into the stairwell. Floyd pushed on it, trying to coax it open. When it refused to yield, he leaned his entire bulk against it and pushed until his face was a mask of effort, but the door showed no sign of moving.
"It's stuck," he said, gasping for breath.
"It can't be stuck," Auger said. "We just came through it."
"It was stiff, though. The whole frame must have subsided. I can't get it open."
"Why did you ever close it?"
"I wanted to hear if anyone came after us. I figured they wouldn't be able to get the door open without making a sound."
"I bet you're regretting that particular bright idea now, aren't you?"
Floyd gave the door one last shove, but it was obvious that even their combined efforts would not be enough to get it open.
"I can see you're the kind of person who likes to say, 'I told you so,'" he said. "Only when people deserve it. Now what are we going to do?"
"Find another way out of this building, that's what."
"There isn't one."
"Down the ladder again," Floyd said. "Our only hope is that there may be doors at the other end of the room." She looked at him dubiously.
"And if there are, do you think we stand any more chance of getting them open?"
"Until we've tried, we won't know."
They hurried down to the floor, skirting around the sphere and the gas tank to reach the far end of the room. There were indeed doors there, twice as high as Floyd and wide enough to drive a truck through. The doors were obviously meant to slide back into the walls on either side, but when Floyd tried to part them, they remained as resolutely fixed as the door to the stairwell. Again he screwed up his face in determination, and again the doors stayed put.
"I think they must be locked from the other side," he said, between heavy, panting breaths.
"Then we're really up shit creek without a paddle, aren't we?"
Floyd looked at her, somewhat stunned by her choice of words, despite the desperateness of their situation.
"Did you really just say that?"
"I'm a little tense," she said defensively.
"Well," Floyd said, "now that you mention it, a paddle would actually be quite useful, or better still, a crowbar."
"What?"
"I think I can see a gap between these doors. If we could wedge something into it, we might be able to prise them open enough to squeeze through."
"Into another underground room?"
"No, I think I can see daylight. Look around. There's got to be something we can use."
There was another violent crash. With a drawn-out groan, the plinth and lathe finally slid through the hole in the ceiling, dragging several tons of masonry and metal with them. The mass of twisted metal hung above them, suspended by a few pipes and wires that had become wrapped around it. It was directly over the sphere.
"That thing's not going to stay up there much longer," Auger said.
"So let's get out before it falls. You check the left side, I'll check the right. Any piece of metal will do."
Auger started searching her side of the room, rummaging through the mess they had already created.
"And be quick!" Floyd shouted.
Auger's hands fell on a piece of perforated metal framing. It was broken at one end, tapered to just the right shape to fit between the doors.
"Wendell, I've got something."
She held the makeshift tool up for inspection.
"Atta girl, that'll do nicely."
She jogged back to Floyd as fast as her heels would allow and passed the piece of metal to him. He hefted it, like a hunter evaluating a new spear.
"Hurry!" Auger said.
He slipped the sharp end into the fine crack between the two doors and started levering, applying his full weight to the task. The huge doors creaked and groaned. Simultaneously, the room shook and the hanging lathe slipped down a good half meter before jerking to a halt again, suspended even more improbably.
"It's working," Floyd said. "I think it's going..."
Something gave a metallic crack, and the doors sprang apart by a thumb's width. A fan of dreary daylight sliced the room in two.
"That's a good start," Auger said. "Now the rest."
"I'm working on it." Floyd renewed his struggle, adjusting the position of his feet to optimize his bracing position. "But I'm not sure how long this thing is going to last. See if you can rustle up another one, in case this one buckles."
She stood rooted to the spot, desperate to slip through the crack. "Verity, get searching!"
Stumbling on her heels, she began to search the other side of the room. She felt her trousers rip against sharp metal, and something cut into her knee. Tripping, she fell forward, her hand reaching out for support. Miraculously, it closed around an iron bar. Picking herself up, barely registering the pain in her leg, she hefted the new prize.
"Got something! Bring it here. I think this boy's about to..."
The fan of light widened. The gap in the door was now big enough to push a face through. Auger started making her way back to the double doors, just as the room shook again, more violently than ever before.
She halted in her tracks and looked up with a horrid sense of inevitability. The plinth and lathe eased through their flimsy restraints with a final squeal of freedom. Untethered, the equipment dropped through the air and landed on the upper surface of the sphere's support harness, before sliding off and falling to one side with a deafening chime of metal on metal. The sphere rocked, but for a moment nothing more happened. Auger forced herself to move again, gripping the iron bar. Then she stopped and looked at the sphere again. There was a whisking, whipping sound as the guy's line's many constituent threads began to break, one by one. She only had an instant to register this before the entire line snapped, whiplashing against the harness with appalling force. The sphere dropped. It hit the floor and cracked wide open along its casting floor, like a piece of ripe fruit. Distorted now, not even approximately spherical, it still managed to roll, picking up momentum with each rotation. Auger followed its trajectory with horror. It was rolling towards the double doors, and Floyd. She opened her mouth to scream, something, some useless warning, as if Floyd could possibly not have seen what was happening, but by then it was far, far too late. The mangled sphere trundled into the double doors, forcing them open and wedging itself in the gap. The metal emitted a horrible noise as it buckled. It almost sounded like a human scream, cut off with sickening swiftness. No, Auger breathed. Everything was suddenly very quiet. Even the demolition machines had stopped. She let go of the bar and heard it clatter to the ground in some distant corner of the universe. Auger slowed as she neared the doors, trying not to think about what she was going to find. Floyd was flat on the ground, lying perfectly still. His face was turned away from her, bright blood matting his scalp. His hat had rolled away into a corner. No, Auger said. Don't be dead. Please don't be dead. You had no business being here. You didn't have to get involved. His body had fallen inside the doors, to one side of the sphere's path, and it didn't look as if it had rolled over any part of him. She took his head in her hands very gently and turned it so that she could see his eyes. They were closed, as if he had fallen asleep. His mouth was slightly open and his chest was rising and falling, but with a worrying irregularity, as if each breath was a struggle. Stay with me, Auger said. Don't go dying on me. Not now that we've come this far. Now that we've actually started to get somewhere. Now that I've actually started to like you. She squeezed his head, her hands wet with blood. Are you listening to me, Wendell? Wake up, you sad excuse for a detective. Wake the fuck up and talk to me. Laying his head gently on the floor, she stood, appraising the gap that the sphere had made in the doors. She could squeeze through it without difficulty, but there was no way she was going to leave Floyd to be buried alive. Sitting back on her haunches, she put an arm around his shoulders and slid another beneath his back, and groaning with the effort, she managed to arrange Floyd into a sitting position, balanced against the right-hand sliding door. His head lolled onto his chest, his eyes still closed. Leaving Floyd where he was, with his back to the door, she scrambled over the sphere and through the gap it had made as it wedged itself between the doors, catching an elbow on the edge of the door as she went through. Beyond, just as Floyd had predicted, was a sloping ramp leading up to ground level. The air swirled with the dust of collapsed buildings. She turned back to Floyd, reaching through the gap and grabbing him under the armpits. Come on, she said. Gritting her teeth with the effort, she managed to drag Floyd off the floor so that he was halfway between a standing and a sitting position, but she could not lift him high enough to pull him through the gap. Exhausted, her arms feeling as if they were about to pop from their sockets, she fell back down on the concrete of the ramp. Every instinct told her to get away now, before the machines caused the entire structure to cave in. She found some last gasp of strength. This time she managed to get his head and shoulders to the level of the gap. His shirt ripped on the edge of the ruined door as she felt his weight shifting towards her, and then suddenly he was falling through the gap onto the concrete ramp. He landed in an undignified sprawl, arms and legs tangled, face squashed against the ground, his mouth open like a drunkard's. Carefully rolling him over, she knelt beside him and took his face in her hands, gently smoothing the hair back from his cheeks and forehead. Floyd groaned and opened his eyes. He took a deep breath and wiped his tongue across his lips. What did I do to deserve this? Thank God, you're all right. All right. I've got a headache you could park the Hindenburg in. For a moment back there, I thought you were dead. No such luck. Don't say that, Wendell. I really meant it. I was worried sick.
He touched the back of his head and came away with a wet palm.
I guess I took a hit in there. Was it worth it?
Still cradling his head, she drew his face towards hers and lowered her own to meet his, and kissed him. He tasted of dust and dirt, but she held the kiss, and when she moved to pull away, Floyd gently stopped her.
It was worth it, she said. I guess it must have been.
She pulled away now, suddenly feeling awkward and silly. Floyd hadn't rejected her, but she felt as if she had made a terrible misjudgment. She looked down and willed the ground to open up.
I'm sorry, she said. I don't know.
Floyd raised a hand, tangling his fingers in her hair and pulled her in again.
Don't apologize, he said.
I've made a fool of myself.
No, he said. You haven't. I think you're wonderful. The only thing I can't understand is what a nice girl like you would ever see in a crumpled old has-been like me.
You're not a has-been, Wendell. Crumpled, maybe. And you could lose a bit of weight. But you're a good man who believes in finishing a job once you've started it. And you care enough about your friends to put your own life in danger trying to help them. This may come as a shock, but there aren't that many people like you around.
Okay. But what about my good points?
Don't push your luck, soldier. She eased back from him. You think you can stand? We need to leave here before we get into any more trouble. I'm still worried about your head.
I'll survive, Floyd said. I'm a private detective. If I don't get clotted on the head at least once a week, I'm not doing my job properly.
He got to his feet, wobbling a little, but able to make his way unassisted.
We'll still need to get you checked out, Orga said.
I'll last until we're back in Paris, Floyd replied.
He touched the back of his head again, but the bleeding had slowed.
Verity, there's one thing I need to say.
Go ahead, Wendell.
Now that we've broken the ice a bit.
Yes.
From now on, I'd really like it if you just called me Floyd.
I will, she said, on one strict condition.
Which is?
You call me Auger. Back home, only my ex-husband calls me Verity.
You're sure about that, Auger?
Damn sure, Floyd.
She helped Floyd up the gentle slope of the ramp towards level ground. You start seeing double or feeling nauseous. I want to hear about it, all right?
You'll be the first to get the news. In the meantime, do you want to tell me what it is you figured out down there?
I didn't figure out anything.
But when I rang the bell, it rang a bell for you, didn't it?
I don't know, she said, shaking her head. I thought for a minute.
Thought what? He prompted, as her voice trailed off.
The spheres are designed to ring. I'm pretty sure of that. The shape and the specified accuracy of the machining and the way they are meant to be suspended. Everything points to the same conclusion, but they're not intended to be rung like a bell. Nothing strikes them.
Then what makes them ring?
In my work, Auger told him, in the job I did before I got involved in this mess, we worked with a lot of sensitive equipment. I'm actually an archaeologist, for what it's worth.
Aren't archaeologists supposed to be graying spinsters with half-moon glasses who never get to see daylight?
Not the kind I hang out with, Auger said. We get our hands dirty.
With this sensitive equipment?
Thing is, in order to make it sensitive, we have to run a lot of it at very cold temperatures. We cool it down, really cold, so that it can work better.
And when Altfeld mentioned cooling requirements,
I started wondering if the spheres were part of some kind of detection apparatus, yes.
Auger bit her lip, focusing her thoughts.
And now I think I know what it is.
So tell me, Floyd said.
The spheres form a single machine, as wide as Europe, one part of it in Paris, one part somewhere in Berlin, another somewhere in Milan. But they're really all part of the same instrument. It simply has to be that big for it to work.
And this instrument is what, exactly?
An antenna, she said, just like the one on a wireless, only it isn't radio waves it's set up to detect. It's gravity.
And you figured all that out just by looking at that sphere?
No, I'm good, but I'm not that good. We use tools for measuring gravity in my work as well. Sophisticated tools for peering through the ground, picking up the density changes caused by buried structures. Needless to say, we had to study the theory of how these things work when we were being schooled up. And that meant going right back to the early history of gravity wave detection.
Maybe I don't read the right newspapers, Floyd said, but I didn't know there was a history of gravity wave detection.
There's definitely a history, Orga said, but it isn't your fault that you don't know about it. They had reached ground level. The ramp emerged in a narrow canyon formed by two long rows of partially demolished buildings, still standing to their first or second stories. Pipes, conveyors, conduits and catwalks threaded the space over their heads.
Tell me what I need to know. This isn't going to be easy for you to follow, Floyd. It'll take my mind off my headache.
Then I have to tell you about space-time. You ready for this?
Hit me, he said.
There's an old saying amongst students of gravity. Matter tells space-time how to bend. Space-time tells matter how to move.
It's suddenly a lot clearer.
The point is that everything we see is embedded in space-time. You can think of it as a kind of rubbery fluid, like half-set jelly. And since everything has a mass of some kind, everything distorts that fluid to one degree or another, stretching and compressing it. That distortion is what we experience as gravity. The Earth's mass pulls space-time in around it, and the distortion in space-time around the Earth makes things fall towards the planet, or orbit around it if they have the right speed. Like Newton's apple. You're hanging in there, Floyd. That's good. Now, let's move up a notch. The Sun pulls its own blanket of space-time around it, and that tells the Earth and all the other planets how to move around the Sun.
And the Sun?
Follows a path in space-time dictated by the gravitational distortion of the entire galaxy.
And the galaxy? No, don't answer that. I get the picture.
You get half the picture, Orga said. What we've talked about so far is a permanent bending of space-time around a massive object. But there are other ways to bend space-time. Imagine two stars swinging around each other like waltzers. You got that?
Sure. I'm admiring the view as we speak.
Make those stars supermassive and super-dense. Make them whip around each other like dervishes, spiraling in towards an eventual collision. Now you've got yourself a pretty fierce source of gravity waves. They're sending out a ripple, like a steady note from a musical instrument.
I thought you didn't like music.
I don't, she said, but I can recognize a useful analogy when it comes along.
Okay, so two stars circling around each other will give you a gravity wave.
There are other mechanisms for producing such a wave, but the point is that there are a lot of binary stars out there, a lot of potential gravity wave sources dotted around the sky. And they all have a unique note, a unique signature.
So if I pick up a tone,
you can work out exactly where it originated.
Like knowing the flash pattern of a lighthouse.
Exactly that, Orga said. But now comes the hard part. Somehow you have to measure those waves. Gravity is already the weakest force in the universe.
Even before you start worrying about measuring microscopic changes in its strength, it's like trying to hear someone whispering on the other side of the ocean. So how can you do it?
She was about to tell him when movement from above caught her eye, a glint of polished metal against the low grey sky. There was just enough time to register the small figure crouched on one of the overhead pipes, and the nasty little weapon it clutched in one claw-like hand.
Floyd, she started to say.
The gun fired, making a rapid, high-pitched laughing sound. Orga felt a sudden warm pain in her right shoulder, and then she was on the ground and the pain became worse. She was still looking up. The child stood balanced on the pipe, seemingly unfazed by vertigo. It held the gun aloft, releasing a sleek, sickle-shaped clip from the grip and inserting another. Floyd took out the automatic she'd given him. He thumbed off the safety catch and took a two-handed stance, squinting against the sky.
"Shoot the fucker!" Orga said, grimacing against the pain.
Floyd fired. The gun jerked in his hand, the bullet winging off the underside of the pipe. The child began to lower its own weapon, taking careful aim. Floyd emptied another two slugs into the air. This time they didn't hit the pipe. The war baby toppled from its perch, shrieking as it dropped to the ground. Its thin little arms and legs wheeled as it fell. It hit the ground, bouncing once, and then lay quite still. It was a boy. Floyd spun around, scanning the buildings for evidence of more children.
Orga pushed herself up on her good elbow, and then touched the wound in her shoulder. She pulled her fingers away.
There was blood on the tips, but not as much as she had expected. It still felt as if someone was twisting a hot iron poker around in her shoulder.
She reached around the back and felt more wetness under her shoulder blade.
"I think that was the only one," Floyd said, crouching over her.
"Is it dead?"
"Dying."
"I need to talk to it," she said.
"Hold it right there," Floyd said softly. "You've just been shot, kid. There are other priorities just now."
"There's an exit wound," she said. "The bullet went through me."
"You don't know how many went in, or whether they fragmented. You need help, and you need it fast."
She pushed herself up and then struggled to her feet, using her good arm for leverage. The war baby lay where it had fallen, quietly gurgling in a pool of its own blood, its head twisted towards them. The eyes were still open, looking their way. "It's the same boy," she said, "the one that stabbed the waiter in Gare du Nord."
"Maybe."
"I got a good look at his face," she said. "I know it's the same one. It must have followed us here."
She hobbled over to the boy and kicked its gun away. The head moved, swiveling around to keep her in view. The mouth lolled open in a stupefied grin, and blood drooled from the smoke-gray lips. The black tongue moved, as if trying to form words.
Auger pressed her foot down on the war baby's neck. She was glad she hadn't managed to snap the heels off her shoes now.
"Talk to me," she said. "Talk to me and tell me what the fuck you are doing building a resonant gravitational wave antenna in 1959, and what it has to do with Silver Rain." The black tongue oozed and wriggled like a captive maggot. The child made a liquid gurgling noise.
"Maybe if you took your shoe off its neck," Floyd suggested.
Auger reached down and picked up the war baby's weapon. She reminded herself that it had a full clip and that the baby had been ready to use it just before it had fallen from the pipe.
"I want answers, you shriveled up piece of shit. I want to know why Susan and the others had to die. I want to know what you fuckers intend to do with Silver Rain."
"It's too late,"
the child said, forcing the words out between gurgles of blood and bile.
"Much too late."
"Yeah? Then why are you in such a hurry to stop anyone getting too close to this shit?"
"It's the right thing to do, Verity. You know it in your heart."
The child coughed, spitting blood in her face.
"These people shouldn't exist. They're just 3 billion dots in a photograph. Dots, Verity. That's all they are. Pull away and they blur into one amorphous mass."
She thought of her dream, of the silver rain falling onto the Champs-Élysées, of the beautiful people picking themselves up and thinking that life was about to go on, and being so terribly wrong. She remembered trying to warn them. She remembered the little drummer boy stepping through the bones. Dizziness washed over her. She suddenly felt very cold and very weak. Auger squeezed the trigger and did something abominable to the war baby. Then she slumped to her knees and was sick. Floyd gently drew her to her feet and steered her away from the bloody mess she had made.
"It wasn't a child," she said. "It was a thing. A weapon."
"You don't have to convince me. Now let's get out of here before those shots attract the wrong kind of attention. We need to get you to a hospital."
"No," she said. "You need to get me to Paris. That's all that matters."